the Reformation in the Christian context went back to the original founders, the apostles. Now, if you apply this model to Islam, where would we go back to the original founders of Islam?
Sociologist Dr. Alvin Schmidt, author of The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West.
You'd go to Muhammad, the man who was in many ways Islam's first terrorist, who conquered the world by the sword, and who said, I'm the last of the prophets, and I'm sent with the sword. And to think that we can have reformation like we had in the Christian context is a specious argument.
You can meet and hear Dr. Alvin Schmidt making the case against Islam on June 14th and 15th in Collinsville, Illinois. It's the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. Check it out at issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
I want to just take a moment to say that our thoughts and prayers are with all of the people in Oklahoma.
Fighting for gay marriage generally involves lying about what we're going to do with marriage when we get there, because we lie that the institution of marriage is not going to change.
If all you're getting is the natural revelation of God, you've got a horrible religion that's not Christian.
When our fathers and mothers fail us, the Lord will take care of us. That's what the psalmist says, and that's important to underscore, and that's why the church needs to be there for those people.
Organists in Indiana love Issues Etc.
My memory of that time is a childhood memory, wearing POW bracelets, MIA bracelets. You remember those things during the Vietnam era? What was that war about? What did it do to the vocation of soldier? What was it like to cover that war? And how much did the journalistic coverage of the war affect the outcome of that war? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. on this Memorial Day. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. In the first hour, we're going to do some Memorial Day reflection on the Vietnam War with Uwe C. Minetto. In the second hour of the program on this Monday afternoon, since yesterday was Trinity Sunday, we're going to study the Trinity hymn, Holy, 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 with Pastor Will Whedon. Dr. Uwe C. Minetto covered the Vietnam War from 1965 to 1969, formerly served as a chaplain to Vietnam veterans. He holds a PhD in theology and sociology of religions from Boston University, and he's author of the new book, Duke, A Reporter's Love for the Wounded People of Vietnam. Uwe, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Wonderful to be back.
How is it that, and I think you said this before in previous conversations, that your coverage, your reporter duties there in Saigon during the war sparked your interest in your study of theology?
Well, it's a curious, it was a very long voyage, but it was clearly triggered by that. 20 years after one of the pivotal events that I covered in Vietnam, which was the Tet Offensive in 1968, where I was in heavy combat up in Hue. Exactly 20 years after that, I graduated from seminary in Chicago and then went on to study theology and sociology of religion for a doctorate at Boston University. So it took 20 years to do this. However, in retrospect, I realized, of course, that Vietnam triggered it all because, as you know, when you study theology, when you have to do clinical pastoral education, and of course the first thing that I wanted to do during this internship was to do ministry to Vietnam veterans. There are other things that happened, which in retrospect I find fascinating. Theologically and also in political history. Look, I was a dapper young man in Vietnam. I was willowy, I was good-looking, I was very hedonistic, I enjoyed the beauty of the women and the good food in Vietnam, and there were lots of wonderful things in addition to the war, which wasn't wonderful, that one could experience. So it would be a hypocrite if I said that I was a sort of fervent Christian. However, I was properly catechized, and I think I told you that before, by my grandmother in Leipzig during World War II, during the bombing. And the one thing that I knew and that affected me in Vietnam, even though I hardly ever went to church, was that when I was in danger, when I was in heavy combat, I sang in my head the Kyrie from the German Lutheran liturgy. And I think that is something that I remember so distinctly. The other thing I remember is that even in these hedonistic days, I always managed to say the Lord's Prayer, and then, of course, this wonderful offertory verse that we sing in the Lutheran Church, based on Psalm 51, "Do not take the Holy Spirit from me." That must have affected me. I know it definitely did affect me, and of course, it came back as I grew older, more and more and more. The third thing I found fascinating, and I find fascinating, and still, obviously, now I'm 76 years old, and one reflects on one's life at that age more than maybe in earlier years, was what happened when I was with people who died in combat. And, you know, there must have been hundreds that I seen die in combat, and held hands as they were lay dying, especially GIs, but also Vietnamese. But in the case of the GIs, I always remember that they were first crying, almost all of them, to their mothers, who were distant, of course, over in the States, and then to God, always in that sequence. And I found this fascinating, that the ultimate cry went out to God. And I suspect, well, I know that this is has also become my ultimate cry. And certainly the more, I'm having written this book now, I had flashbacks very much like the Vietnam veterans have. For example, the smell of putrefaction that you have, the stink of death in your nostrils. You know, after 2 weeks in combat, my fatigues, everything smelled of death. And now, having written this book and finished this book, these sensations return. And but now I can put them into proper order, so that it's very helpful.
So, how would you describe your time there from 1965 to 1969?
Well, there were different phases. The very early, so you know, I arrived in January 65, almost after a year. I arrived still in an enchanting city, French colonial city, where French was the common language. I speak French. I had an immediate rapport with the Vietnamese people. It was a very elegant place. It was a place of extraordinary beauty. And a fascinating race of people. You noticed that subtitle is "My Love as a Reporter for the Wounded People of Vietnam." I fell in love with these people for a number of reasons. I knew they were being wounded. I knew they suffered. But first of all, of course, the women were spectacularly, and still are, and I meet them now in Orange County. There's a big city there called Westminster Garden Grove, where you have 200,000 Vietnamese. They are spectacular beauty, but they have this strangely beautiful combination of sort of willowy figures. You know, they look frangible, and at the same time, they're extraordinarily beauty with a very earthy sense of humor. And very, you know, very hands-on. I love that. I mean, I come from Germany, and the best of the German women that I know have this soft quality as well, and I like that. The bawdiness appeals to my Lutheran sense of humor. On the other side, however, you have these extraordinary Vietnamese men, Confucianists, the men who dream the perfect dream, who seem unrealistic. They're not, of course, but they're very scholarly. withdrawn, introverted, cerebral. And I found this combination stunning. You know, I came from New York, from a totally different culture, and I had this extraordinary thing. Then, of course, I found the first inkling of that, the first idea that things were going wrong in Vietnam, when I encountered the various strategists who were there, because we knew this war was going on. I had read up on the political history and the ideological history of the Vietnam War carefully. There was a man by the name of Bernard Fall, who was actually a Viennese Jew who became a French citizen, fought in the French military during the French resistance, and then became a professor at Howard University in Washington, which is an essentially African-American university. Well, Bernard Fall wrote the definitive works on Vietnam at that time, and he pointed out that genius, the evil genius, if you will, of the communist guerrilla war against, or war of terror against the South Vietnamese, and ultimately against the Americans, before that against the French. A general by the name of Vu Nguyen Giap, who is still alive, he's 101 years old, had predicted that the enemy, in his terms, by which he meant, of course, Western liberal democracies, are neither politically nor psychologically capable of fighting a prolonged war, long drawn-out war, to a victorious conclusion. And he also devised, based on Mao Zedong, the strategy on how to fight this war, and the strategy, of course, involved primarily terror. The vilest form of terror you can imagine, and I hope we'll discuss this later in the interview.
Let's take a break right there, Uwe. When we come back, we'll pick up your story on the other side. We're doing some Memorial Day reflection on the Vietnam War on this Monday, May the 27th, Memorial Day. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Our guest, Dr. Uwe Simonetto.
Hi, this is Jonathan Collin from France.
Thanks to God's gift of the Internet, people are listening to Issues Etc. around the world.
First, I would like to say thank you very much for your program. It very much ministers to those of us who are outside the comforts and the luxuries of having a confessional Lutheran congregation nearby. Thank you very much for this great resource.
Listen to what you want, when you want, wherever you are. IssuesETC.org.
Does your church need a backup organist? The virtual organist service from Church Music Solutions is the next best thing to an on-site organist. Send us your musical choices, including liturgy and hymns. We'll assemble your service and send it to an iPad that controls your church's organ on Sunday. The result is genuine organ leadership on your instrument with your selections when you need it. See our videos on YouTube or visit our website at churchmusicsolutions.com.
Educating a new generation of Lutherans, you're listening to Issues Etc.
The Church's Music from the 20th Century. The 17th Century. The 11th century. The 8th century. The 4th century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Memorial Day, some reflection on the Vietnam War with Dr. Uwe Simonetto for this entire first hour of the program. Uwe covered the Vietnam War as a reporter from 1965 to 1969. Uwe, you were telling the story of your involvement there before the break, and you were talking about the communist strategy of terror. That's a loaded word nowadays, obviously. What did that word mean during the Vietnam War?
Well, terror meant, for example, blowing up a restaurant, a floating restaurant filled with civilians right outside my hotel, or to the right of my hotel on the Saigon River, the Mekong restaurant. 40-something people died. That's one form of terror. Terror also meant, and that is very significant because that's how the communists did it in China and how the Vietnamese communists did it under the French. Murdering, slaughtering civilians in villages. And if I may recount one incident that stuck to my mind, and which is something that Richard Nixon later quoted from me in his book, The Real War. I had attached myself to a South Vietnamese regiment, and we were called, this was in central Vietnam, and we were called in the middle of the night to a village, very distant village, that had been visited by the Viet Cong at night, that night. And we were arrived there after Viet Cong had left, maybe an hour after Viet Cong had left. What we found when we got into this village, this is the South Vietnamese Union, the American advisors and me as a journalist, in the center of the village, dangling from trees, were the mayor of the village, or the village chief, as it was called then, his wife, and their 9 or 10 children, all the way from toddlers on up to the age of, say, 14. The male members with their genitals cut off and stuffed into their mouths, including the children. The women with their breasts cut off, horribly tortured. And they were hanging there. And the entire village population was forced to watch this massacre. The Viet Cong had come in, woke everybody up, and said, "Now look, this man, your village chief, elected village chief, mind you. I mean, they had local elections in those days. Your guy is supporting the Saigon puppet regime, as the communists call that. We've been warning him not to do this. We've been warning him to change his ways. He hasn't changed his ways. Now you'll see what will happen." Then they proceeded to kill in front of the parents first the children, first the toddlers, and all the way up, slowly butchering them as an act of, you know, as an act of war, cold-blooded. As this is how you do it. This is how, as you would fire a gun, except in this case they butchered them, and the entire village had to watch. And finally, of course, they slaughtered the mayor. Now, that was called phase two, the guerrilla warfare falls into three phases. First is agitation propaganda, and then the second phase is guerrilla warfare and terrorism, that sort of thing, plus agitation propaganda. Finally, you have the all-out conventional war, as we've seen it then later in Vietnam towards the end of the war, or the second half of the war. Now you must understand, this country was large. You had and it had four core areas, from the north to the south. First core area was in the northern part of South Vietnam, and the fourth in the southern part. So when journalists in Saigon reporters went to the what we call the 5 o'clock follies today, the briefings by the military and the civilians, they would cite incidents. And so you would have, say, in I Corps, the first Corps, 365 incidents the previous 24 hours, the two Corps, 420, et cetera, et cetera. But they never recounted or never told you and told, therefore, the public in the United States or elsewhere in the world what these incidents were. Some of these incidents might have just been sniper fire or a mine people treaded on. Other incidents were exactly what I've just described to you. And I have a feeling, well, I know, in fact, that the Americans, the general public in America, was not aware of that nature of the war. Otherwise, they would have been. Of course, you know, I can't even fault my American colleagues because this happenstance. I happened to be there when this occurred. I mean, I happened to be with this particular unit. But that is what the nature of this war was about. It was evil through and through.
I want to talk to you a little bit about this war in terms of the vocation of both soldier and journalist. But before we get there, your general reflections in the book on the media coverage of this that you've already touched upon here, you classify it as from beginning to end, including the American withdrawal from Vietnam, theater of the absurd. What exactly do you mean by that?
Well, it was an absurdity in so many ways because you had the absurdity was on both sides. By the way, it was also on the side of the authorities, Americans or Vietnamese authorities. It was covered in a way that you would not cover normal events in the world. It was covered. Unrealistically, surrealistically, because precisely the regular war correspondents like myself, and there, here I included my American colleagues too, there were many brave journalists who went into combat and tried to be as competent and tried to be as fair as possible. But at the same time, you had the media stars fly in, directed by their ideology, if you will, who portrayed and were given a totally false portrait as well of the conduct of this war, both by the authorities or by the head offices or by whatever convictions there were. And unfortunately, their reporting prevailed in the public mind. You went to the 5 o'clock follies, as we all had to do, but some 70% of the journalists in Saigon never went into the field. So you had absurd discussions. You have a briefer, and he would say, for example, well, we have a complaint from Central Vietnam that said some American Marines had urinated against the Buddhist pagodas, and now the monks are all upset. Actually quite an irrelevant event, but you had these self-important people who never went into the field. They had to run a story. So now for half an hour or an hour, they discussed the manner in which the American soldiers had urinated against the temple. Should they have urinated? And then false Buddhist theology and all that sort of thing. That finally, there was a drunken German correspondent friend of mine who was always boozed, and he always had this off. He always preceded his questions with "ah." So he and finally he said to the briefer, "Why don't you tell the Buddhists to get themselves a submarine?" That was the ultimate of absurdity. He wove the liquid nature of this incident with the absurdity of this discussion, which literally had nothing to do with what was going on in Vietnam. And what was going on in Vietnam, which is, I think, what the Americans have never understood, is that it was the hot war extension of the Cold War. Ho Chi Minh was never a freedom fighter. He had always been, since the 1920s, an agent of the Soviet Comintern. And that aspect of the war got totally lost on the American public and on many of the American media, not on those of us who were actually in combat and saw what was going on and were often very, very moved by the bravery and decency of the soldiers, American or South Vietnamese or South Koreans, who were also there.
With only about 30 seconds here, about a minute or so, would you say that the history of the Vietnam War has been built upon that theater of the absurd that the media coverage
yes.
was? That it still that still prevails today?
Definitely. It was definitely, and I'll give you a best example. The Tet Offensive in Hue, in South Vietnam, when the communists invaded hundreds of towns and cities, and which was a public relations stunt, in which the communists lost, their entire infrastructure was lost. They lost half of their manpower, okay, and which we, as combat correspondents, saw happen. We knew that militarily that offensive was lost to the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese, and actually won by the South Vietnamese and the North and the United States. Then came Walter Cronkite. Later, after it all, it was all over, and in a crisp sort of set of fatigues, went into the field and looked, of course, very authoritative, and then declared this war unwinnable when it was won. And so then he said, we have to sue for peace with honor. And of course, you know, it was a very dishonorable peace because ultimately the United States betrayed its Vietnamese allies.
When we come back, I'd like Uwe's thoughts on the vocation of soldier, especially in light of our reflections today on the Vietnam War. Dr. Uwe Simonetto is our guest on this Memorial Day. He covered the Vietnam War from 1965 to 1969, and he's author of the new book, Duke, A Reporter's Love for the Wounded People of Vietnam. You can purchase this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. When we come back, has the vocation of soldier changed? Has our perception of it changed in light of the Vietnam War? We'll be right back.
Steadfast Lutherans, people who believe the traditional Lutheran preaching, liturgy, and hymnody continue to deliver Christ crucified for sinners today. The Reformation attempted to return the Church's focus on what we do for God back to a focus on what God does for us, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures. Some things never change. The Gospel is still under attack from inside and outside the Church. To see how Lutheran doctrine and practice preserve the Gospel, visit steadfastlutherans.org.
Yes, there is a Messiah in Seattle. Messiah Lutheran Church and Concordia Lutheran School have served North Seattle for over 60 years, and we invite you to join us on Sunday mornings at 8 and 10:45 with Bible study at 9:20. Messiah Seattle is proud to support Issues, etc. To learn more, watch our adult information class videos online or on DVD. Our website is messiahseattle.org, 206-524-0024.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
I'm going to be making the case that postmodernity, rather than dying and going away, has actually become the default setting for the way people think in many of the churches today.
Chris Roseborough, on his presentation, Postmodernism in the Church, at the Issues, Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 14th and 15th in Collinsville, Illinois.
As a result of it, it constitutes a significant threat against biblical, historic, Orthodox Christianity because its epistemology is extremely irrational, subjective-based, and in fact, it's even a form of enthusiasm, God-withinism, that at the end of the day has as its project the eroding away and deconstructing of what historic Christianity teaches and confesses.
You can find out more about the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 14th and 15th in Collinsville, Illinois, at issuesetc.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Memorial Day, some reflection on the Vietnam War with Dr. Uwe C. Minetto. Uwe, you spend quite a bit of time talking about the biblical doctrine of vocation, that God assigns a station or stations to us, wherein we live out before God in faith and before our neighbor in love. And one of those vocations is the vocation of soldier. I'm interested in your reflections on the vocation of soldier, especially in light of your experiences and their experiences during the Vietnam War.
Well, Luther compared the work or the craft of the soldier to that of a surgeon who might have to cut off a limb in order to save the body. This is very much the way I experienced soldiering in Vietnam. And I mean, I will not deny that there were war crimes, individual war crimes were committed by dysfunctional American or South Vietnamese units, but this was against public policy. It was not the majority. The majority of the American and South Vietnamese and South Koreans and Australian soldiers were incredibly conscientious. I've seen an American lieutenant, for example, a platoon leader, throw himself on a live hand grenade in order to protect with his body, save the lives of civilian bystanders. Of course, he was killed by that. That sort of thing I've happened all the time. I found them, obviously, these were sad people. I mean, you must imagine the soldiers the Americans sent over, most of them were conscripts. They were draftees. They were kids, 18, 19-year-old. They went in there and they tried their very best. Sometimes they were badly led simply because they, like every army in a prolonged war, their leadership got killed or wounded or stuff like that. But that was, again, the minority. The majority of what I saw were highly competent, highly conscientious, decent officers and men fighting there. And when I came back, Todd, and then found that, in my therapy group for Vietnam veterans and pastoral care group in St. Cloud, Minnesota, that every one of those, I had three groups with altogether 90 people, every one of these soldiers had been called a baby killer within 24 hours of returning to the United States. There were soldiers in my group. One soldier told me that he was thrown out of his church because he still had a crew cut and wore his uniform, and the young bearded pastor who had replaced the old parish pastor said, "You have no business being here. Come back when your hair has grown and when you have some decent clothes." There were this horrible behavior, the spike in Dear John letters, women dismissing their boyfriends or husbands as they were in combat. In one case I cite in my book, a woman sent actually a video of herself with a lover, was a peacenik. And of course the soldier went absolutely bananas. He went out and she raced out of his camp and fired his gun all over the place until they finally grabbed him and said, "You need R&R. These things need to be taught. It was irresponsible. It was a self-indulgent society in the United States when you were young or before you were even born in the United States. You know, make love, not war. Stupid phrases. Drug is in dancing, free sex, all these things." And the Vietnam War was an impediment to their lifestyle, And so they turned against those poor guys who were drafted, ripped out of their homes, and sent across the world into an alien culture, an alien jungle, having to fend for themselves and defend their country without probably ever having been properly advised on what they were doing there and why they had to do that. I found this so moving and so touching, and I'm still outraged, as you can hear. I'm very angry about it, as I'm angry about the fact how the Vietnamese population, which I found enchanting, was bad-mouthed in the American media, how their government was bad-mouthed. In the middle of the war, they had free elections, and I covered these elections. They were free. And the other side, that was supported by many of the liberal media in the United States, was a totalitarian dictatorship very similar to the Nazis or to Stalinist Russia or China, communist China. The way this was handled, I found absolutely appalling. The Vietnamese people came over. Do you know that 200,000 drowned trying to flee their country? Throughout this war that I covered, none of us has ever seen people running in the direction, South Vietnamese running in the direction of the communists to find protection there. They ran in the direction of the Americans, and once the Americans left, in the direction of the South Vietnamese alone. And when there was only about a square meter of territory left, they ran there. And finally, they were abandoned. And that, to me, is one of the most... And they're being ignored by the American media. I live in a county, Orange County, California, where you have this huge Vietnamese population, all successful. They all came over with nothing and built up careers. They're fantastic, good citizens. And they're hardly taken note of by the local media. I find it astonishing.
So would you say in summary there that both the kind of the culture of the United States at the time, early mid-60s, early 70s, together with the way that the American Western media decided they were going to cover this war regardless of what actually was occurring there, did it lead only to the perception of the loss of that war, an unwinnable war, or did it actually lead to the actual loss?
Well, it led to the loss because the Americans pulled tail. In 1973, they concluded a foul deal with the North Vietnamese, leaving 250,000 North Vietnamese soldiers stationed in South Vietnam, fully armed, of course, you know. Then, of course, Congress decided, again, under the influence and under of the culture and false reporting, not by most journalists, but by those journalists whose stories hit the front pages or the editorial pages. Then Congress decided to stop supplying arms to the South Vietnamese, and so the South Vietnamese lost, and at the cost of millions of lives. That is so. What was a perception became reality. It was a perception, as I said. Americans perceived, for example, the Tet Offensive in 1968, which was the pivotal event there, to have been a victory for the communists when it was in fact quite the contrary. It was perceived as that because of people like Walter Cronkite. Walter Cronkite was probably the worst offender in this thing because he had this huge audience and he had enjoyed the trust of the American population and the American politicians, etc., etc., etc. When he says the war is lost and we should now get out, we've done our best, what could we, as other correspondents, do, although we've seen and written that actually the other side had committed nothing but terrorist acts. Mass graves were found. Todd, there was a mass. I stood at the rim of a mass grave with thousands of bodies of women and children. Some of those women buried alive. You could see the grave was found because the women who had been dressed for Tet's Vietnamese New Year. The women tried to claw their way out of their mass graves, and you could see the manicured fingers, beautifully and freshly manicured for Tet for the New Year. And we stood there, and my friend Peter Braestrup, who was then correspondent for the Washington Post, noticed an American television team that didn't film this. And he turned to this guy and said to the reporter and said, "Why are you not filming this? I mean, this is grisly here." And this idiot said, "Well, we are not here to spread anti-communist propaganda." That was an American journalist. And his own people had been dying to fight for the liberation of a town where communist cadre had gone from house to house with lists with names of people to be taken and executed and shot after kangaroo trials. Up to 6,000 people were killed that way, including, by the way, three of my own fellow countrymen, doctors who came there to teach their medicine. And then you have had journalists, not the majority of the journalists, but they were the ones who called the tune, who said, "Well, we're not here to spread anti-communist propaganda."
Dr. Uwe Simonetto is our guest. We're reflecting on the Vietnam War on this Memorial Day. It's May the 27th. When we come back, he spoke at length here about the American press and the way that the American press distorted the truth about Vietnam during the war. He covered the story for the German press. Was it any better there? We'll be right back.
Uncle Sam, need me. I gotta go to Vietnam. Uncle Sam needs me to war. And I gotta go to Vietnam.
Did you know that we send out an email each week that details upcoming show topics? It's available for you to include in your weekly church bulletin. Just click the logo for the Issues Etc. Journal and Weekly Bulletin insert at issuesetc.org and sign up to receive the Church Bulletin blurb. It's an easy way to invite your fellow parishioners to listen to Issues Etc. Issuesetc.org, look for the Issues Etc. Journal logo, and register to receive a weekly bulletin paragraph from Issues Etc.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
Educating a new generation of Lutherans, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Have you wondered what classical Lutheran education is all about? Are you a Lutheran homeschooler? Would you like to learn more about teaching students the essentials of biblical interpretation, law and gospel, or worldviews from a Lutheran perspective? Come join the Consortium for Classical and Lutheran Education July 16th through the 18th at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. For more information, visit ccle.org. That's ccle.org.
Would you like for us to post information about your congregation on the Find a Church page of our website? We'll add your church when it becomes part of the Issues Etc. 300. We're looking for 300 congregations to donate $1,000 to Issues Etc. Please consider adding the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. to your church's mission or advertising budget. Find out more about the Issues Etc. 300 at issuesetc.org. Click support and publicize your congregation to the world.
Folks, Father's Day is less than 3 weeks away. We have a great idea for a Father's Day gift for your dad, for your husband. send him to the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June the 14th and the 15th, right here in Collinsville, Illinois. He'll have a chance to both meet and hear from some of Issues Etc.'s best guests, Dr. Rod Rosenblatt, Pastor Will Whedon, and Chris Rosebro among them. It's a two-day conference, $100 per person, including three meals, June the 14th and the 15th, right here in Collinsville, Illinois, right in advance of Father's Day. You can register him online, issuesetc.org. Look for the logo of the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, or give Craig a call and he'll help you register dad or your husband for this Father's Day present, the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, 618-223-8385. Dr. Uwe Simonetto is our guest. We're talking about the Vietnam War, reflecting upon it on this Monday, Memorial Day, May the 27th. Uwe, before the break, you were talking about the poor job, to put it lightly, that the American press did during the Vietnam War. You were covering the war for the German press. Was it any better there?
Certainly the papers I covered it for were very supportive. They were sometimes a little goofy and a little provincial. It was far away, but, I mean, they were on the right side. So I had no complaints. But I'll give you an example. You know, I mentioned the scene of this massacre in this village. And I told a prominent editor of the leading German news magazine called Stern, S-T-E-R-N, this scene. And I said, you know, Stern was very anti-American. You guys are actually supporting a regime that is very similar to the Nazis. They acted exactly like the SS in Russia or elsewhere. And he said, oh, my friend, you see, you're too close to the scene. You don't really understand what's going on. Yeah.
Well, that kind of brings us to vocation of a journalist.
Right.
You mentioned that you've given us kind of a laundry list of journalists that didn't leave the hotel, that didn't go into the field, journalists that showed up in their crisp fatigues for the camera. To make kind of summary judgments and wrong ones. What are your thoughts on the vocation of a journalist in light of how poorly it went in that respect during Vietnam?
My story about my line about journalists is that it's a vocation as any other. We're here to serve each other. The journalists have an incredibly important function because the journalist provides the information upon which the sovereign of a democratic nation like the United States can base his decision. The sovereign of this of the nation is the voter. So unless you have a fair and balanced and honest reporting, obviously we all make mistakes. We're all human, and I know I made some grisly mistakes in my 57 years in journalism. But that is my main function. It is as important as the farmer providing food. It is as important as the soldier providing security or the policeman, and as important as the president of the United States or Congress providing government. Unless we do this conscientiously as journalists, you cannot have democracy, and democracy is bound to fail. And that is one of the most dire conclusions that I have drawn from in my book, also from my Vietnam experience, our democracies, our life is at risk, our free life is at risk, if we pursue something like that, the way we eat junk food. Oh, we get tired of a donut, throw it away, and say, well, it's bad food, you know, having eaten. That sort of thing, that is what has happened in 1975 or 1973 when the Americans left, ultimately, and then 1975 when the South Vietnamese were driven into the sea.
You spoke earlier a little bit about the treatment of soldiers when they returned from Vietnam, not only at the end, but all the way through deplorable treatment. And what would you say is the lesson that our country ought to learn looking back on how it treated its veterans, and in many ways how it's forgotten many of these veterans after that war.
Well, I do believe, though, that the United States has learned on that level, has learned its lessons from the Vietnam War, because the veterans are, at least by the populace, well received. I mean, you see it how you see the way the soldiers are being uniformed, men are being treated at airports and airplanes. That is not. I think I'm quite sure that veterans, especially wounded veterans, dealing with PTSD cases and all that sort of thing, it needs a lot to be desired. But this is the one lesson I respect the American public for, the current American. They did learn their lesson on that score, and that's good. I'm quite sure the veterans have a lot to complain about now, but you also see the private support for wounded veterans broadcast and missions like that, which I find very heartening. What I find less attractive is that America is about to throw away again its veterans, not in the same sense by bad-mouthing them, but by, I fear, pulling tail in Afghanistan by announcing foolishly, not only America, Germany and Britain and other NATO countries as well, by announcing publicly the withdrawal. And so therefore, all these people who have died and got wounded in Afghanistan or in Iraq might have sacrificed their lives or their health in vain, because the evil forces that they had finally sort of driven out of the main urban centers like Kabul will return, and you'll have the same system again that subjected women to the most horrible treatment, that stoned them to death, that didn't allow them to drive a car or to go to school or to study. And all this is, of course, coming back. You cannot, totalitarians like Islamists or communists will not change their idea simply because the Americans had lost thousands of lives there. And that is, I think, one of the most contemptible ways of dealing with the sacrifice of these men. I mean, how must a wounded soldier who lost his limbs or his eyesight, like my father did in World War I, how must he feel when in 2015, for example, the Taliban are back in Kabul and the women are being stoned together and have to run around in chadors and will not be allowed to study and drive a car or any of these things. That is something that I feel the American public should seriously ponder.
Uwe, with only about a minute and a half before we have to close up our conversation,
yes,
what would you say to a Vietnam vet listening to us right now?
Thank you. I would say thank you. You've done your best. If your leaders and if your voters, your population have let you down, you have done what you had to do. And they should take heart of that. We live in an imperfect world, as we know, and especially as theologians, we know that. And there's another thing that's very important that I also keep telling my Vietnamese friends. We are not the lords of history. Somebody else, thank God, is the lord of history. And the Vietnam vet who thought he had been, who had flipped off God because he thought God had left him alone and had abandoned him in Vietnam, should take heart that the lord of history has not abandoned him, but has actually been on his side and suffering alongside him in Vietnam. As he has suffered alongside me in Vietnam, even though I wouldn't fully recognize it at the time.
Dr. Uwe Simonetto covered the Vietnam War from 1965 to 1969, formerly served as a chaplain to Vietnam veterans, holds a PhD in theology and sociology of religion from Boston University, and he's author of the new book, Duke, A Reporter's Love for the Wounded People of Vietnam. You can check out this book under the Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org. Uwe, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thanks very much, Todd.
In hour two of Issues Etc., we're going to spend some time with Pastor Will Whedon, Director of Worship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. And since we're coming off of Trinity Sunday, the celebration of the Trinity, the special celebration of the Trinity, I should say, we're going to study a Trinity hymn, Holy, Holy, Holy. Pastor Will Whedon will be our guest. The new Issues Etc. journal is out, and I've got an article in there called What God Cannot Do. It's useless to speculate as to what God might do or can do. Scripture offers the only comfort that we have as sinners in what God did do in Jesus Christ. You'll read all about it in that article in the latest Issues Etc. journal. Also, Pastor John Fraser has our Wittenberg Trail feature, From Self-Focus to Christ-Focus. He tells about his story of decision theology, then a little bit of Reformed theology, finally landing in the Reformation. It's all there in the latest Issues Etc. journal. You can subscribe for free, issuesetc.org. Look for the big red button, enter your email address, and we will send you the latest Issues Etc. journal. I'm Todd Wilkin. Hour two of Issues Etc. in 5 minutes.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Greetings from your friends at Zion Lutheran Church, Muscoda, Illinois, a proud supporter of Issues Etc. Zion Lutheran is a welcoming, family-friendly church that's firmly grounded on the unchanging truth of God's Word. We receive God's gifts of grace in a timeless, reverent way each Sunday morning at 10 o'clock. Zion Lutheran is located at 101 South Railway in Muscoda, Illinois. Zion Lutheran is a church home that's both faithful and friendly, and you'll be warmly welcomed. For more information, call 618-566-7345.
Is baptism a mere symbol of rebirth? Is it a prize for attaining a certain amount of faith? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May is Lutheranism 101, Holy Baptism. It's written by regular guest Pastor Charles Lehman. You can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org, or you can purchase Lutheranism 101, Holy Baptism by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Lutheranism 101, Holy Baptism.
How would you like to attend a conference and hear Rod Rosenblatt, Will Whedon, Chris Roseborough, Al Schmidt, Suzanne Venker, and Todd Wilkin? You're invited to the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 14th and 15th in Collinsville, Illinois. Registration is $100 per person. For more information, visit issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 14th and 15th in Collinsville, Illinois. issuesetc.org.